Art and Bullshit
We're about to do it
Podcast.
different this time.
Art and Bullshit Podcast.
By popular request. You know, I'm not even sure what episode this is, but you are rocking with the best.
Art and Bullshit Podcast.
I have no clue what episode this is, so bear with me, you guys. It's another episode of the R&BS Podcast, the podcast by artists, for artists, and art lovers. I'm your host from the West Coast, James Gerald, broadcasting from the slums of 10th Street in Indianapolis, Indiana. Oh, yeah. Let's get some housekeeping out the way. Shouts to the cats over on Apple holding us down. Homies over on Spotify hit us with the Wrapped Up. We'll see you over there at the end of the year. Y'all got the 5-star. We need that rating. Two niggas over on Patreon. We appreciate you guys for holding us down with the financial support. Miscellaneous listeners using those apps on the web. We see you and we appreciate you. Announcements. This one's a different one, you guys. You've seen the cover art. And I'm being interviewed, so I think that's kind of a cool thing. But we're going to be announcing actually tonight, which is in the past. We're going to be at the Harrison Art Center for the 18th opening, but that will have already happened. So by the time you guys get this across your desk, you'll hear some more reviews and stuff like that. What else we got? All types of stuff for sale. If you guys are looking to expand your painting collection, hit me up. If you guys are looking for some merch, check out the Teespring. You can get hoodies, you can get coffee cups, all of that good stuff, and rep the brand. You know, you might have to match a hoodie up with those brand new Cement 3s you got, man. Lastly, I'd like to give a shout out to all of the artists in Indianapolis who have contributed to this run, the Circle City Circuit 3.0. First time listeners, you guys, if this is your first time listening to this episode, I don't know why this is the first time listening, but we just roll with us. Return family members.
You saw me just get out of the whip. I mean, we here.
Yeah, we back. Wait, hold. Wait, turn me up.
It's not your situation. I just need contemplation.
Episode 133.
I'm not so systematic. It's just that I'm an addict for
all my podcast family, what up? All my painters, where you at? Smoke it if you got it, sip it if you got it, you know it's really popping. You gotta come in, we got a switch up for you. Dr. Jared Dorch taking over today. Start y'all off with some of that urban soul since we, you know what I'm saying, we rocking with urban soul, you know what I'm saying? Smoke it if you got it, sip it if you got it, what y'all got?
Art and Bullshit Podcast.
Shouts to all my ladies breaking hearts, breaking pockets, securing bags and popping tags. I feel like we should keep y'all moving though. You know what I'm saying? Get to it.
Art and Bullshit Podcast.
I've been getting off that soft right now before shorties was rocking off right.
We are back, episode 133, man. Tapped in like a tourniquet.
So many Cardi's whore thought I was cross-eyed. You better off just let sleeping dogs lie.
Thought
he was on that lie, what he tweaking off? Doggy, that's more than a Chiba high.
This is that Rock Marcy.
Cheater ain't a cheater and you ain't a boss till you take a loss, that's a loss leader. Lost a leader and tossing Nina out the Porsche. You won't see them. Shit different, they just in it for clout. A nigga lit now, can't just be giving dick out. You know the in and out, so you want a child, but I'm only interested in a mouth. It's always the ones you love fucking the most. Stunting your growth, can't be comfortable enough to unbutton your coat. That goes for straight up hoes to get rope. I'm no dating coach, I don't fly on a plane of coats. Y'all don't know me. I might pull out the coyote and
what you got? You got that macchiato, y'all on that French press. All the cats with the brevet, I see you. All my niggas picking up pumpkin like spot lattes. So they can remember old girl's name.
The Bible won't be the only thing holy.
I peel my face off, it will feel the same.
Let's keep going, let's keep going.
Don't take it.
Don't wait for her, man.
Midwest
well, elegant, more
buddy. 3.0, episode 133. Y'all know the vibes.
Bye. Ink well, elegant, ball better, she miracle. Flash two perennials, pointed shy with the terrible. Graveyard football, sound guy, very sight. Batman, Earth Slam, Joker to the Tanzanite. Matt Black Dynamite, blast radios, black radio. Score capability, fly cohesivity. Fly guy, do or die, best style, energy, simplify. BEY, these hoes hilarious, with cardiac serious. Cartier tank top, blow the central bank up. Told where you bank truck, nah, baby, it ain't luck. Days without a wave. We prayed and we made one. See the God grace us with flavors and fountains. X amount of mountains, X amount and X amount is countless. The wizard is a fraud, what you afraid for? Saw a lot of thunder, no rainfall. Keynote, the city glowing, give the geometric shoe 11.
Stars of the story got a moving different. Goofy niggas, they hate being their jeans, look, it's their true religion. If it isn't love, it must be new edition. Fly guys, now we don't believe in superstitious. Superman and man, see through the system with my supervision. Power, spirit of gravity like tabernacle.
Sometimes I got five out on this with y'all.
Keep it deeper than an Adam's apple. Yeah, even more than before. I said what I said, cause I saw what I saw. Son swore he ain't your boys, but always calling the law. I got him acting unhinged like a door on the floor. Yeah. I'm never silent, always speaking up. Personally, I find this shit cowardly. Niggas weak as fuck. I'm just no peace, too much. Never be enough. Louder than the bomb, I'll be turning up till the speakers bust. Living on the road, mama framing my tour poster. Stay away from these industry agents, they all vultures. Breaking up these toys, cause they faking as small soldiers. I don't know why they do it, but it can't be for the culture. It's slamming like Costa Nostra. Be in love with the coca, they hit niggas with the Rico. Way people put it in cola. For generational wealth, they standing on their ancestors' shoulders after burning down Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, yo,
Cole, we just gonna use that as is.
Yo, my grandma bumped this shit, bro. Dead ass.
Alright, let's just get to the interview. I ain't even gonna hold you.
Art and Bullshit Podcast.
Alright, once again, I'm Dr. Jared Dortch, and I run a podcast called Urban Soul Radio. And today we're gonna get with my man, James Gerald. He's coming to our town, laid down a lot of information, put me on game, and I wanted to make sure that the world gets a chance to actually hear where you're coming from and your perspective on a lot of things. So we're just gonna jump right into it, because I don't play with nothing. So let's go ahead and do this. Where are you from, and how does that affect your work?
So, whoa. Let me get some. What's going on over here? Hold on, let's pause. Okay. Oh, that's kind of tight. Okay, so where am I from? I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. I moved to California when I was really young, so I don't have any memories of Indianapolis as a child, honestly. Let me make sure the year good. Okay, cool. All right, so Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm a kid. I moved to California, and then I grew up there, lived there until I'm 16, got kicked out of Edison High School, ended up moving to Indianapolis, which is where I was born, went to Arsenal Technical High School, and then I moved to Seattle, Washington in, was it 2002, 2003? lived there for like 7 years, came back here for 2 years, and then moved back to California.
Okay.
So how that affects my art, I would say that. So I think it's one of those things where I started this whole artistic journey like with graffiti. That was kind of when I got real serious about art. And the thing about graffiti was going to different places in different regions, you would paint with people, you would pick up different techniques and things like that. And I think living in California,
so in the world, man, what is up?
This is annoying me. Okay. So I think it's one of those things where I picked up, I started this whole artistic journey like with graffiti. That was kind of when I got real serious about art. And the thing about graffiti was going to different places in different regions, you would paint with different people, you would pick up different techniques and things like that. And I think living in California, Washington and Indianapolis, which are drastically different environments, they're drastically different. They have that drastically different cultural inhabitants, and they have drastically different views on what they're bringing to, you know, art, be it fine art, be it music, be it textiles. So I think there were different things that I picked up. Indianapolis was a place that.
So following that up, who would you consider, your greatest artistic influences?
Through graffiti, because there's no direct reward for it, and your output directly affects your impact. So the more you do, the more people see it, and then you get there's a feedback loop. So it's like, oh, I saw this thing, I saw that thing. But if you're not working hard and going out, then there's a lack of paint on the surface.
So following that up, who would you consider, or what would you consider your greatest artistic influences?
Greatest artistic influences. Let's see. Define. I would have to say my dad. Because when he was, or when I was a kid, I would see my dad draw from life. He would look at things like a lamp or, you know, my mom's table or the TV, and he would draw all these things in blue ink pen, and he would draw them on yellow lined paper. And it was just like compositional drawings, a bunch of drawings on one page, and it just page after page. And for some reason, you know, I mean, he had to pay bills, so that was a luxury he couldn't afford. So that would probably be my first artistic influence. Second artistic influence that was like really monumental, because I've had a host of like phenomenal like friends that were like, they're really skilled at painting and stuff like that, but I would have to say a really life-changing moment was probably my dear friend and the co-founder of Art and BS Podcast, Mike Wagner, who fine art painter in Seattle, Washington, was the first black man that I ever saw that had a art show. So being a graffiti writer and then also being a fine artist, shout outs to Big J, one of our mutual friends, was like, hey, you need to meet this guy. He, you know, he has an art show, like, I think y'all will be friends. So Mike had a show, and it was called Seattle Legends, and he had these big 4-foot by 4-foot portraits of he did Jimi Hendrix, Bruce Lee, Kurt Cobain, and Paris Hilton. And they were all oil paintings, and I remember the richness of the pigment. And up until that point, I had only used acrylics, and I was thinking, like, why do these browns look so rich? And it's like, well, dude, that's raw umber. That's like burnt umber. It's supposed to look like that. Because it's not plastic. It's made from, like, minerals. It's not plastic. So that's why it looks like that. And I didn't know that at the time, but I would say those two, and then moving into Broadway studios. Hopefully that works. Moving into Broadway studios, Fresno, California, I think because up until that point,
let me think, because this is a very crucial moment in my artistic career. Because there was a point due to adversity, Jared, that I started to focus in the realm of fine art and try to and try to like understand things in a more. Oh God, this is annoying me. Where are we? These chords, you guys, just bear with me. Nope. I'll edit this so it's a lot cleaner, Jay. Just bear with me. I'm like, I don't know what that is. I'm going to get some new chords soon. So there was a point, like, after I went to the Sean, because I took a workshop with Sean Barber, who's like one of my favorite painters. Okay, this is like, I'm just annoyed by this. Well, I don't understand why this. Okay, we're gonna pause this. I'm gonna figure this out. And we're back. So this is like so annoying. So you guys, essentially, I was really trying to process in my brain. There were two moments that kind of were in the same 9-month time frame. The first one was when I went to the Sean Barber. It was a Sean Barber taught an A La Prima portrait painting class when he and Carl Dobsky had the Safe House Atelier. So anyone who knows, like, Sean Barber, he's the guy who did the Obama portrait for the New York Times. Carl Dobsky, a really prolific painter, probably my favorite narrative painter currently. Great. And what's interesting is they painted totally different in that session. But that's not the point. The point was, I go there and I'm like, I've never been starstruck, but I'm starstruck because this is one of my favorite painters. Well, and, you know, and every time I meet my favorite painters, I do that because it's the impact that these people have had on my life. I don't want that to go unnoticed. And as artists, sometimes we think people don't care, you know, like, you know, but I geek out because it's like, whoa, this is really, I mean, man, you hit that jump shot. It's just like basketball, people geek out. So as an artist, I look at, you know, fine art, like creative athletics. So I'm geeking out. I'm in their studio. I'm getting a chance to see the new painting that Carl Dobsky was working on. And it was the one that it's like a poolside scene where everything's on fire and like all these people are at a party at a pool. It might be in Rome or something right now. And it's kind of like it was a crazy painting, but I got a chance to see it. And we talked about it. And I said, I said, Carl, like, there's this one painting you did and it was like all your homies in this boat. And like, how did you do that? And he said, it was a culmination of everything I've learned. I had to get the raft. I had to set up studies so I could draw all the people in the correct lighting. And then I had to like put all of those things together so they worked compositionally. So when I hear things like that now, it makes a lot of sense because you want a unified light source. You don't want one person to look like it's the daytime and one person to look like it's the nighttime because light affects all objects in a similar manner. If they have especially if the material is similar, right? And there's the way that we model form. So I got a chance to see that the painting in that particular stage and ask about these other paintings, which I never thought about all of these things going into them. Or maybe I did because that's kind of what I'm doing with my artistic practice, like getting the small things down so I can put them together. However, that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is it's time for class. So everybody sets up and all of these are their students that have been there for a minute. And I set up right behind Sean Barber because I feel like, if I'm going to pay for this class, I want to be able to look and like cheat and look over his shoulder and see what he's doing. And I'm going to tell you guys something. That's not how this stuff works. Okay, cool. All right, we're still recording. Okay, cool. That's not how this stuff works. So, because you can look over an artist's shoulder all day, but if you don't know what to look for, you're not. Some things you'll get, some things you won't.
You can stand in the kitchen with me all day, but you ain't going to cook like I could.
Yeah, for sure. So, first session, because it's a 3-hour block. They're broken up into like little increments. So you get a break, I think after every 25 minutes. So first session, you know, everybody's like drawing and I'm looking around. I'm like, okay, I'm trying to get the guy's general pose on the, on the panel. I was going for like a gesture while all the rest of the students, they were mapping in proportions. So it's like, okay, like one third from the brow line to the top of your head, one third from the brow line to the bottom of your nose, one third from the bottom of your nose to the bottom of your chin. The bottom of your eyes is right in the middle of the face. And no one's saying this, but looking back, that's what they were doing. So they're really taking their time, slow is steady, steady is fast. And I'm trying to just get the gesture. Okay, bong, bong, bong. All right, I kind of got the gesture. Break. So we have a break. And I'm thinking, okay, all right, I'm doing pretty good. So, you know, I get a chance to go over because Carl Dobsky was set up at the back of the class. So I go over and check out what he had. He was kind of teaching some techniques on how to establish a gradient. So that was kind of tight. So break's over. Session two. So it's time, I have my overall gesture, which for you guys who don't know, a gesture is basically the outline of the head. So just picture I painted the way that the head would kind of tilt. And then after that, I have certain landmarks I'm trying to go in and boom, second session's over. Break. So Sean comes over and I look and I start seeing my neighbors. They, on their paintings, they actually, since they were doing it by proportions, it's like, okay, well, it's a simple formula. Just connect this here, connect this there. This goes here, this goes there. So Sean comes over to me. He's like, hey, James, you mind if I help you out on this? And I was just like, no, because it was crazy. So then he kind of shows me. He's like, okay, well, you got to get the center line, right? First thing you want to do is base things off a center line. So he's like, yours is kind of off. So then he draws like the center line and then he goes in and maps in my proportions. Like, okay, look, that your eyebrow line is too low. It needs to come up. There's no like all of this stuff. So really quick, he maps it in and it's like, okay, wow, this is kind of the thing. So with these workshops, what's kind of cool is, and in the graffiti community, it's kind of frowned upon, but I think in the fine art community, so many artists have kind of gone through their instructors painting on their paintings. Like when you go to the Getty, there's a painting that let's just say, how can I say this without giving too many beans? There was one time I had a chance to see a painting that it was a Rubens painting, but it was very valuable and it was in a place. And I've talked about it on this podcast. You guys can kind of put two and two together, but I'm going to work because I don't want to. This is a real touchy subject. So I saw a Rubens painting and it wasn't a Rubens painting. It was actually one of his students' paintings. But the thing about Peter Paul Rubens is he painted on all of his students' paintings. So if it's a Rubens student, it's actually a Rubens painting. So it's one of those things where, or if you go to the Getty, that's where I was trying to get to. When you go to the Getty in the Rembrandt room, there are like all these Rembrandts, and there's one Rembrandt that's one of his students, but the hand he painted, and the hand that looks completely different than the rest of the painting, because that hand is a Rembrandt hand, right? So having Sean Barber paint on my painting, it was like, oh, this is like this is how it should be done. You know what I'm saying? At the most proficient level. And I worked the painting to the best of my ability. It was all right, but I felt like they ran circles around me in coming every week and actually having a method and a game plan to make this picture. So after that, it was like, oh, I got to step it up. You know, like if I'm going to try to do this, I got to step it up. So my work changed after that. So I would say that was probably a defining moment.
So following that up, so what do you consider to be your favorite medium to use?
I like oil paint. Charcoal's really nice. I'm dancing between those two right now. As far as experimentation, I'm really trying to learn those mediums and understand what the capabilities are of oil paint.
Well, that's what the capabilities charcoal. Is. You're trying to figure out what the capabilities is. I ain't mad at you. I got you. I know I heard better than you said.
Hey. That's great.
So another question for you. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite time of day to create, man?
It changes depending on what's happening. Sometimes I'm really active in the late hours of the night. Sometimes I'm really active, and it also depends on what I want to paint. So if I want to paint something that has natural light, then I have to paint during the daytime. But then the thing is the light moves, so I have to like kind of be fast in that. But if I want to paint something that's like a longer, I know this painting is going to take me 3 or 4 days or a week or 4 months. Those are usually, I'm going to start it at night probably and set up some consistent lighting and then just go in because I know this is how my lighting's going to stay.
That makes sense. I was thumbing through your book, How We Got Here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, one, if that's going to be another edition coming out or.
Yeah. I'm working on the second one right now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And how did you come to create that piece to begin with?
Yeah, you know what, Jared? It's something that I always said I was going to do. Like, hey, I'm going to make a book. And it was supposed to be like a memoir because my life is extremely crazy. I think it would be funny. It would be insightful. It would be inspiring. But I said, okay, you kind of did a little bit. In 20 years in art, like I went from, you know, tagging on dumpsters to figuring out how to make an oil painting. And I wanted to document that to show the growth and development because there's at times we go through a rebrand in our life. You know, if you've been working at Shell gas station for 20 years, people know you as the dude who works at Shell gas station. So you have to be like, hey, yeah, exactly. So you have to actually show like, hey, no, this is what I've been doing. This is what I've been having under my sleeve for all these years. And I think that was, for me, it was important to put things in perspective and take a look back and kind of talk about some of the experiences because I'm really, I'm good at sharing one-to-one, but as far as on a broad scale, I'm not great at stuff like that. It was hard to write about failures in that book, but it's like, well, that's what comics are interesting, you know, yeah. So let's go ahead and do that. So that really was what inspired me to do it because, and also people, a lot of times they'll ask me about graffiti and I don't want to talk about it. So I just felt like it was easier to put it in the book. And then that way they can see like, oh, okay, James, actually, he has some experience in this route.
So that's interesting to me because I had a conversation last night about narrative through the work. So obviously a book is a narrative piece, but the pieces that are in the book, how much do you feel that those pieces are implicit narrative or explicit narrative? Like,
okay, so my goal, in that particular book, I would say the overall body of work creates a narrative. I don't think that there are a few paintings in there, like the Homer Rockwell, where it's like Homer Simpson doing the Norman Rockwell triple portrait. And that was a painting that I had to figure out, A, how to research, because I had no clue how to really research for a painting. And I talked to my homie Mike about it. And he basically gave me some pointers. And what I found was, okay, if I'm going to make this painting, I don't, because when I try to do things like that, I don't want to do something that's been done. So I get on Google, is there a Homer Simpson, Norman Rockwell painting? Homer said, and I look, I'm like, okay, I haven't found it. Okay, cool. So the second stage is how do I draw Homer Simpson? Because I don't know how to draw Homer Simpson. I mean, I could look at the cartoon and draw, but that's kind of cheating, right? Like, then you're basically taking Matt Groening's, like, drawing or one of the in-betweeners, and you're just transferring it on your thing. So what I did was I did a 6-point turn. I drew Homer from the front, from the back, and from two sides, and then, like, angles, right? So then that way I could actually, oh, this is how Homer looks from all sides. So in my sketchbook, I had to like do thumbnail drawings and like, okay, this is a 2x2 inch, like rough sketch, like literally 1x1, 2x2 of like how this whole painting is going to look. Because if I can't distill a painting down into light, dark, and a midtone, then it's probably not going to work in its totality when you put it on the canvas. So after like a thumbnail, because I was basically using Norman Rockwell's composition with Homer Simpson, I changed a few things. Like there were some Duff beer cans in there and stuff, but I had to watch a bunch of The Simpsons to kind of figure out like, okay, what where am I going to get these little art notes that go on the canvas? So I'm watching all these episodes, and then I came across the episode where Mr. Burns has an art vault. And I was like, wait, there's an episode where Mr. Burns has an art vault?
Mr. Burns has everything. Yeah. Everything. He did and had everything.
So I was like, whoa. So I'm like, okay, let me take some of these paintings out of Mr. Burns's vault and throw them into my painting. You know what I'm saying? So that was kind of the thing. The process behind that. But when you talk about like implicit versus explicit narratives, a lot of times my paintings are like just to see if I can do something. So it's a straight proof of concept. Like, for example, Nelson Mandela, I painted this Nelson Mandela painting, and it was like I didn't think it was a good painting by my standards, but I had it in my studio, and First Thursday came and some dude who had a dispensary wanted to buy it, and I was like, okay, sure. But this was just to see if I could paint Nelson Mandela in 2 hours off of a picture. So most times it's me experimenting. I haven't until recently really gotten into trying to create narratives and things like that in paintings. So yeah, I hope that answers your
question. It does it helps a lot. Also, explain to me what you feel that art does to society. Like, how is art important to society, in your opinion?
You know, I think that art is important to society because it allows people to express themselves. Art doesn't need to be bought or sold. Art is something that we do as children. We do in our homes, we do as hobbies. So it sometimes is a release for some people. Sometimes it's therapy for some people. And for some, it's a quest to figure out like what's possible. So I think art contributes the possibility of what humans can do. And it also allows those humans to directly relay their unique experiences in a fashion that's specific to them and the tool set that they are choosing to adapt to. Because some people want to just do watercolor paintings and they want to go to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and draw and paint race cars because watercolor dries fast and it's a quick setup, quick takedown, and that medium is unique to that particular artist. Some people want to take oil paint out and they want to paint Yosemite. Some people want to use tempura. And tempura is basically, it's a pigment, and you use an egg, you separate an egg and you use the yolk and you mix the pigment with the yolk, and it creates a sort of paint for you know, you guys, like, a lot of you guys know, some of y'all don't know.
I hear tempura, I'm thinking about some shrimps, some broccoli. Mm-mm. Like, yeah, I feel you.
Yeah.
So, I learned something new on that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can get really bright colors with tempura. With tempura. It's like tempura, T-E-M-P-E-R-A, not tempura.
Oh, tempura.
Yeah, tempura. Yeah, yeah. So you can get some really, like, you know, chromatic hues with that. But I think that without art, and this isn't specific to visual art. Without art in any form, we couldn't tell the story of what's happening around us. And sometimes that might not be the most prophetic story. It might just be
the story.
You know, yeah.
Just the story. Mm-hmm. So talk about stories. Let's talk about a little bullshit real quick.
Okay, let's go.
The Wire or Sopranos?
Art and Bullshit Podcast.
Probably The Wire. Because The Wire is something that was dear to my heart. And it was really like Baltimore. I don't know how the Sopranos, I can't attest to the validity of that particular series. I know it's great, but The Wire hits in a way that I think it resonates with me because there's no happy ending.
No.
And I think that not only was it, because The Sopranos, like, it's a family, but The Wire is a community. Yeah. And for there to be no happy ending for a community, except one person, you know what I'm saying? Because the ponytail boy made it out, but outside of that, nobody else made it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. The Wire was actually, to me, because at the time I was living in Newark, New Jersey, mm-hmm. and I hadn't watched it really. Like, I watched like the first season or something, mm-hmm. but and I got caught up, and then it was like happening around me as like the fourth season. I was actually teaching in urban school down there, you know, at a high school, and like they were in the schools, and that was I was like, man, it was just the total reflection of what I see, like the desperation, like the loss, the tragedy. Like I used to tell my people, like, man, I go to school, man, and like there's like nothing in their eyes, man. Like they don't even want to be here. Like they don't even want to be here as in alive.
Yeah.
Like this, it's almost, and I hate to bring it down, but it's just the truth. So like Sopranos is my stuff. Like that's, I love the show, but I just think for me personally, because of the situation that I was in and the approach that I had and what I was trying to do, it just hit right home. Like it hit right home. I think the character study is also really interesting as well. But I think that also tying that to what you were talking about earlier, I think I think if we could look at each piece of art that we do as a character, and each of them is a study of a different character. Like each one is a look at something that happened at a frame of time that exists because of something else.
Well, I mean, paintings are a lot like plays. Like there's a stage, there's lighting, there's an actor. Sometimes there's a supporting cast. So I might have a painting and the actor is a cup of noodles. And then sometimes there's a supporting cast and it's, you know, some lighters and a tube of oil paint so I think that paintings are a lot like theater in that particular aspect. We want to create a sense of drama. We want to create a sense of maybe urgency in the brushstrokes, if that's what we're going for. Or we want to create an allure of mystery and draw people in. But I think it's really important to treat all the objects that are in our paintings like they are supporting stars to the main star, because sometimes the supporting stars make the sketch, like Ashy Larry. Like every Ashy Larry sketch, like Donnell Rawlings, like he doesn't even have lines in a lot of those, but his facial expressions are that makes it. Man. So it's like, how do I implement that into a painting? How do I implement this thing that's a supporting actor but doesn't outshine the main object, but it adds so much character to this, it strengthens the integrity of the overall image? So that's kind of what I'm thinking about in the terms of picture making at this point.
Definitely I feel you. So what motivates you to create? Like what gets you, like what things prompt you to go out and start doing some things, you know?
It's one of those things where there's always a curiosity for me, and
that's the chord.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Now we found the culprit. Okay, dang, I have to get new XLR cords, but that makes sense. Okay, so what motivates me to create? Sometimes I'm motivated by my artistic bucket list, things that I wanted to paint. And I'll get to like, oh, okay, I want to paint this mixer, or I want to paint this particular thing. And then sometimes there's something that I feel like I'm missing in art. So, for example, I did this painting. It was a small study of Yosemite. And a lot of my paintings, we'll paint environments and they'll be like sunsets or nighttime cityscapes. You know, they're illuminated because there's electricity inside of these structures. But I was like, okay, James, how do you paint something that's in the broad daylight and you have this bright mountain, you got this bright field, and then you have this other mountain that's completely in shadow, but it's daytime. So how do you convey all of those things that are kind of competing with each other, but then there's a harmony to it because it's all in nature? So that was one of a painting that was kind of like, let me see if I can do this so I can understand how to create an environment that's in the daytime but has elements where shadow is completely overtaking like a third of the you know, the shapes that are in the painting. So sometimes it's, let me see if I can do this, and then that way I can do it later. Or sometimes it's, I got to paint this because it's a commission. But usually it is it's to see how far James can take something or what James can do. That's, I think, the overall, the foundation of me painting is always like, what am I capable of? You know, and that's, I'm always like fighting to see where my limits are.
Once again, this is Dr. Jared Nicholas Dortch. This is Urban Soul Radio, taking over art and BS. My man James Gerald's here. what I've noticed, and I say way too much for a communications instructor, with the time that I've been around the art game, especially in the African American community, mm-hmm. I haven't seen a lot of landscape painters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we had a discussion about this some, and I want to get into that because I know that you do landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've seen a lot of landscapes in general, just knowing art, you know. I mean, we're sitting here, my Google Chrome thing is playing yep. a bunch of landscapes mm-hmm. on the screen. Mm-hmm. That's just something that you get used to.
Mm-hmm.
But do you, first question, I guess, is why is it that you've chosen that path? And second question is, it's kind of like baseball. Like, why don't black folks play baseball no more? Like, why don't black folks do landscape no more?
Fantastic. Great question. So I didn't paint landscapes until I met Nigel Robertson, owner of the Vatican Custom Framery, and Norberto Ramirez, fantastic oil painters out of Fresno, California. They both paint in the tradition of the Florence Academy out of Florence, Italy. So they're really big on landscape painting. And up until then, I never painted in plein air. So it's like, all right, we're going to take all of our stuff and we're going to drive to the middle of this like place and set up on these rocks and like paint over a cliff. And it's like extremely difficult. Probably the most difficult thing you can paint is painting outside. Like, you guys try, go take your stuff, set up outside and just try to paint, you know, a park. Go to a park with some trees and try to paint it. And here's what you'll find is sunlight moves, shadows move, and they move rather rapidly. So if you don't understand where you want those shadows to lay, as things start moving, you're going to start panicking. Right. And you're going to say like, oh, you're going to look at what's in front of you, which is nature. You're going to look at your painting and you're going to say they don't match up. Well, they shouldn't match up, because what your job is as a plein air painter is to create a snapshot.
Capture a moment.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah. So you're probably going to start right. Like, let's say you started. Okay, so we want to paint into the effect. So let's say we start painting at like 3 in the afternoon. So we have like good lighting, right? So like by 5, it's shifted and hopefully you have your block in. Hopefully you're starting to like dial in your shapes. So you don't want to change the drawing. And I think that's the thing. And I'm talking real technical, you guys. I really got away from his question, but I'm hoping to, with my experience in this blurb, kind of tell you the things that I find fascinating about landscapes, because they're extremely challenging. And I think that they strengthen me in other areas as an artist, as far as my decision-making and my photographic memory. There is a lineage of black landscape painters. Like when I think of Robert S. Duncanson, when I think of Henry Oswa Tanner, when I think of Edward M. Bannister, those are like fantastic black landscape painters. And Robert S. Duncanson is the only one who is kind of strictly a landscape painter, but Oswa Tanner and Edward M. Bannister, they tackled still life. They tackled, you know, narrative paintings. They did the figure. They kind of did it all. But I think that there's a lineage of black landscape painters that's kind of gone unnoticed, or it's kind of, because there's no, you need people to bring attention to certain things. So if no one says, hey man, listen, it's new Jeezy and DJ Drama, you're not going to know about it. So to answer your second question, black people and landscape painting, two things. We as a culture are not natively, we don't really push our families to go to places like national parks. Like, you don't really see a lot of black families like, hey y'all, we just took a trip to the Grand Canyon. You know what I'm saying? That's not, so I mean, like, and think about it, for those growing up, like, think about how many times, and I will say this, being in California, I was kind of an exception to the rule. My parents took us to Sequoia when we were kids. So, you know, I got a chance to see the General Shermans, and General Shermans are like redwoods on steroids.
They're like the big boys.
Yeah, yeah. The big boys. Yeah. So, but I think that's the thing, is we're so used to urban areas, and it's, you don't want to paint something that's fucked up, right? Because that might remind you of, you know, the try. But I think that there's beauty in that. But at the same time, the reason I feel like there's not like a lot of black landscape painters is because there's not a lot of black people they are really pushing outdoors. You know, like, hey, let's go to this park and like, or like, you know, we'll
let's go camping.
Like, yeah, let's go camping. Let's go camping. Yeah.
So there was a group that you put me onto. I started doing some reading before things went downhill last night.
Mm-hmm.
The Highwaymen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about the history there.
And you know, so essentially the Florida Highwaymen, black landscape painters in Florida, I believe 1940s or 50s. And the thing about these guys, and I recently, folks, I found out about them because I was looking up black landscape painters. I'm like, okay, what black landscape painters are there? And I think what I was really looking for was some women who were black landscape painters, but that was like few and far between. Mm. So the Florida Highwaymen came up, and it was interesting because, like anything, it starts out of necessity. You get these brothers down in Florida who are just painting nature, painting the beach, painting the rocks, painting whatever they can get their eyes on. And I think that's like an exception to the rule. And if you notice, they were painting nature. They weren't painting the city. So it's like we're getting out of day-day and we're going to go to the beach. And that way we don't got to think about that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And maybe that just proves my point. Because the Florida Highwaymen were painting nature. And then they had a sales force that would actually load up the paintings in their trunks. And then they would go to doctor's offices, dental offices, parking lots, just hit the lot and sell everything out the trunk. Because
That's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a tradition for us as people. That's what we do.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
The street team. You got a rapper and
you got a street team, right?
Yeah, you
got
to have the mouthpiece on the street, mm-hmm. the mouthpiece on the mic. Let's go.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, you guys, they were buying these paintings for $5, $15. And this is like back in the, you know, the 40s and 50s. And then there became they got a little headway. They got a little steam. And then some of the leadership changed. And then people started falling apart.
That's what happens to the best of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep, yep. So then, boom, it falls apart for a bunch of years. And then recently there's a resurgence of, oh, what happened to the Florida Highwaymen? So now all of these paintings that people bought for $5 and $10, they're selling for $15,000 and $30,000.
But also, like, you have to think how dangerous it was for them on the highways down in Florida back in the 40s. Like, I'm not going in the woods anywhere in Florida. I'm in the city. Like, I'm not going to be in the middle of the woods. I saw Rosewood. I'm cool. Like, mm-hmm. I'm cool. Like, but that's what's interesting. Another dynamic of it is, like, how dangerous that actually is. Like, get caught outside by yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know? That's serious. But I'm glad that we talked about that because mm-hmm. it touched on a lot of things that I think that we'll go into this next question about, like, what is your philosophy of art and of life, like, mm-hmm. and how those mix?
We're only here for a certain amount of time. I think with art, my whole philosophy is, the artist has to do what's best for them and not just in the short term. So, and this is the way I like to look at things is let's say I want to get into, okay, so when I originally started art, this whole thing, I was like, I want to get in a museum. That was my whole goal. So, in my brain, I'm thinking about like all of like, you know, Rembrandt and let's see who else, like Bouguereau and Dorch and you know, John Singer Sargent. I'm thinking of painters like them and like, okay, I have to paint like Sargent in order to get in a museum. You have to be Sargent, and that's so not true.
But we're kind of taught though, like even when we go as a child, like this is like the ways, like these are the people that are in the museum,
mm-hmm.
so obviously they are the way to get into the museum. Like, or if you're in the art history class, I said that the other day, like these are the ways, like we all know certain artists because they're the ones that are in the museum. So you're like, you know, if I want to get in there, like if I want to be the best rapper of all time, like I gotta be big, you know what I'm saying? I gotta be, you know, Jay or, you know, whoever you think is in that top.
Right, but here's the thing though, Jared, is what I learned later on in life is certain museums are just collections. They're just art collections of rich families. So it's basically a millionaire who bought a bunch of paintings and then put it in a building. So it's
to
like
make some more money.
Yeah. Right. So it, okay. So then now I'm like, oh, well, I just got to sell my paintings to people who might one day have a collection or, and you know, I've had some paintings in a museum and you know, I want to get in other museums. It's just a start. But I think as my artistic career moves forward, there's always my a key point in my philosophy is always attempting to get as close to the thing as possible. So whatever the thing is that I'm trying to create, if it's a cup of coffee, if it's a laptop, my goal is in the first, you know, step of this particular staircase for the viewer to immediately recognize this thing. Because there's nothing worse than someone coming in looking at your painting and saying, "Who is that?" And you're like, "It's Barack Obama," right? But that never happened to me.
Right.
But like, but people will all paint obscure people like West Side Gun, and people will be like, "Who is that?" And then I'll say, "Well, you're not gonna know even if I tell you." And then they're like, "Oh," I'm like, "It's West Side Gun," and they're like, "Who's that?" And I'm like, "See, you like."
You got a phone in your hand. Go ahead and look it up.
For
stop
sure.
it now.
Yeah, so.
Stop that. Ain't no reason to be ignorant no more.
You know, or I'll paint my family members.
Yeah.
And people
that's
ask,
a little different
like,
word.
Who is that? Yeah. And it's like, well, that's my nephew. You know, that looks like Kendrick. Well, all black people look alike.
Yeah. yeah.
So I think, you know, my philosophy is learning on all of these, on every painting, and then being able to use that particular skill set, like, do I want to make a loose painting? Do I want to make this painting tight and more refined? And it's based on how I feel at the time. Do I want to just, you know, get it out when it's wet on wet? Or do I want to come back and spend some quality time with this painting, reworking the ideas and rethinking how to approach this material that I'm attempting to create?
So how does that play into the way that you, your philosophy of life in general then?
How you do one thing is how you do all things. Whenever I do something, Jared, I get like neck deep into it.
Yeah, I understand that.
I was out at the bar with one of my homies, and we've known each other for 22 years, and he's seen me do a bunch of different things. And he said, "James, the thing I can say about you is you're a great novice. Like, you come into everything as a novice, eager to learn, and then it's like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, because there's no ego, there's no nothing." And I think that comes from being in graffiti, and there was a book by Espo, The Art of Getting Over, and there were these rules in there, and one was, "You're a toy until further notice."
Mm.
And I have a saying, "You not lit until somebody who's lit tells you you're lit."
Yeah.
That's how you know you're lit.
Yeah.
So it... until I get to the point where it's like the people who I look, and now it's kind of cool because, you know, people who I look up to, they have my paintings in their collection, or there's graffiti writers who I look up to and they'll be like, "Yo," you know, I'll get compliments. And the thing is it's not like I'm getting a big head, but I'm like, "Oh wow, all my work, senpai noticed me."
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, you're accomplishing some of the goals that you had set out for, you know.
Yeah.
That's like, just personally, when people I'm part of the 18 Collective, Black Lives Matter mural, we did that here in Indianapolis. When other members of that group even just be like, that's dope, then I feel like, I won't say validated, but I feel like, I mean, I can stand up with them now. Like, I can be with them. Like, I've been, this whole time, I've been trying to get there, but once they be like, "Okay, I see what you're doing there," or "I understand that," or "I feel you on that," or "That's real good." And I'm like, yeah, okay. Now, but being me, like you said, now it's like, oh, I have to step up to do something else different now, or do something better than what, because I want them to continue to be able to say, you know, not just one and done. I want it to be a continual growth. And I want them to say, "You know what, I thought that was dope, but now, come on. You know, I'm trying to get to that point, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's what everything that I try to do is the same way. Like, I want to continue to build and build and build until I can't build no more.
Well, just from the talk we had the other day, in between the rule of thirds and like transfer drawings, that's going to take your art to a whole nother plateau. Just using those two principles in itself.
Which is interesting, because my next question for you is, what would you have asked if you had the opportunity to do what I've been able to do, to be around a group of individuals, around artists? Like, I know that you've been around, like, what are the questions that you would ask yourself if you were an up-and-coming artist and you wanted to know something?
That's a great question.
Once again, this is Dr. Jared Nicholas Dortch, Urban Soul Radio takeover of Art and BS Podcast. My main James Gerald's in the house. I'm going to give him a little bit of time to think about that.
Yeah.
We're so happy and appreciative to have you listening to us either on the air or on your podcast, you know, wherever you listen to us at, we appreciate you.
Here's what I would say. Don't be afraid to throw it away. Don't be afraid to wipe the paint off the canvas. Sometimes you just need to start over. Sometimes it can't be fixed. The drawing is so bad. Yeah. It's like a toxic relationship. Right? Like, the trust is broken. Things have been messed up and there's just no way. And you love the person, but for you as a human being, you can't be the best version of yourself in that environment. So you gotta bounce. So it's like that with art. Sometimes you'll do things and you'll rush through a problem and then you'll add another problem on top of another problem. And you're like, why do I have all these problems? And instead of like trying to fix a mountain of problems, just take your rag, wipe the paint off, and just start over. Because I think there's a, we have to really understand the experience that we get from making a painting doesn't solely revolve around the actual painting. So you can make a drawing, rip it up, and then you still have all of that stuff in your head that you're going to use on your next drawing. Those mistakes, you're probably not going to make all the same mistakes. So, and that's happened to me. Like, there's times where I've just been like, okay, this painting's not working or this drawing's not working. I'm just going to start over, because if I can't do it again, then I'm a fraud. You know what I'm saying? Like, anything done once, like, if you can't do it again, it was an accident. You know, so I should be able to do what, and it's always going to be a little different, but the feeling, the overall message and the content of the peach cobbler is the same.
Yeah.
But this week it had more nutmeg than it did last week.
Like, I was going to say, it's kind of like cooking, you know, sometimes it's just not good. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not going to give this to nobody. Like, you know, I'll be like, I ain't going to give this shit to my dog. You know what I'm saying? He'd eat it, but he'd be like, what is this, bro? Mm-hmm. Like, so yeah, that sometimes you just have to, and I'm learning that too, because part of it's being like, I won't say cheap, but cheap. Like, I don't want to buy a whole lot of stuff and then mess it up. Like, when I do stuff, I do it intentionally. Like, I want it to work out. Mm-hmm. But I'm learning that I need to be able to say, no, this ain't going to work. You know, there's no way of fixing this. And then now it's getting worse and worse. Just let it go. Especially when it comes to like, canvases, like working on like I'm at a prime over this, you know.
Man, I saw Russell Harris. He sent me some pictures and he had a commission painting and he painted the dude's head and he was like, look, I messed up here, here, and here. And then he's like, look what I did. He took a piece of sandpaper and sanded dude's whole head off and repainted his head. And I was like, you can do that? And he's like, yeah. And I'm just like, you have to really, and actually, what painting did I do that on? There was one painting, actually, I was like, I wonder if I can do that. And I sanded it down and I repainted something. I have to remember which one that was. But, you know, I think that it's not being tied to this thing and understanding that there's value in experimentation. There's value in a freestyle. There's value in, you know, practice on the court. So when you're practicing and you're playing with your folks at the court, you're going to try a spin move or a shot you might not try when it's game time.
No, definitely.
Just to see if you can make it, right? Yeah, so that's what we're doing with drawing and painting.
What Allen Iverson say? Practice. We're talking about practice. Practice. This ain't the game. Not the game, practice. We talk about practice.
Yeah.
But I think to a certain extent, though, depending on the time that you have and the available time that you have to put into it. Like for me, like if I get in here and I'm working, I have to produce something, like because I don't even have the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding it now more, but I think that's kind of what has not allowed also me to be like, you know what, I'm just going to cast aside because I just don't have the, like I was talking about the inventory, I don't have the cachet that I can just be like, you know, I need to come in and do something that's going to be going to somewhere like soon.
Yeah.
But the more time that I have and the more time I choose to make for myself to do these things, I feel as though I'll be able to allow myself more grace as it comes to these different aspects of it all.
Right. So, like I'll do like little drawings like this just to kind of figure out where things go. So I just show them, I have like a little sketchbook, you guys, that I doodle around in and just kind of, you know, work out like little landscape ideas or whatever. If there's like a painting or something, this is trying to figure it out. But
like he literally has drawings of lighters and power cords in here. I like that. That's what's up.
Yeah.
Constantly drawing stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a lot of my brother's collection is a lot of just sketch work, like, yeah. just him drawing stuff.
Right.
And that's what I've been told to do. Like, one of the questions I was going to ask you, but this kind of answers it for me, is that, like, how do you, what do you do to keep going? Like, what do you do to grow and to get better? But it's practice. Yeah. It's,
Okay, because here's the thing, like, I want to talk about with practice, okay? So let's say you guys have a coffee cup. So you have a coffee cup and you want to draw it or paint it. So the average person would say, oh, I'm going to draw this coffee cup and, I'm going to draw it and there's going to be the form and then there's going to be a shadow on the table. And let's say the light's coming from here, like the top right side. So the average person would draw that. But an artist would draw that and then they would say, okay, what happens when I move the light to the left side? What happens to the shadow when I move the light to the bottom side? And you do all of these different lighting effects in your sketchbook. And then that way, when it comes down to painting, you're like, oh, the first idea I thought was just lighting it from the top, but lighting it from the bottom gives it this ominous feeling. So maybe I should go with that. So I think working out those kind of ideas, because I talk to artists and they're like, oh, I can just think of something and it's like, bro, that your brain can only come up with what it can come up with. And once you put that there, unless you actually draw it and you're looking at it and you draw it in another condition, then it's kind of hard to, unless you got some weird supercomputer that just like has form and you know exactly where everything should go and you never misplace a Terminator line and like all your highlights are in the right places. But you know what I'm saying? Yeah, no, that didn't happen.
Not the I'll be back line, like the Terminator.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the whole thing though, Jared, is working out these ideas, different perspectives. Is it going to be higher than eye level, lower than eye level? Where's the lighting coming from? And all of those things allow us more options when it comes time to the picture making.
So what's most important, technique, subject, or philosophy?
I'm real big on technique. Subject, I think, is kind of important. But then I don't know, because I feel like if you paint a turd and you paint it well, then it might
be. That's some good shit.
Right? It's some good shit, but it's like a turd painted well versus a Bentley painted poorly.
Yeah, I took the shit. You know what
I'm saying? Right. So I'm really big on technique. And that's kind of to my detriment sometimes.
Okay. No, I don't say, I got a friend of mine, I can talk about him all the time. Mm-hmm. He is technique, and everything he does, it's got to be right.
Yeah, but at the same time, Jared, it was to get myself ready so I could talk this stuff in the proper language. So we're about to start talking, I got two different series kind of in my head that I'm working out. And I think that they should be interesting.
But this makes a lot of sense going into my next question. Like, how do you navigate the professional art scene? Like, from your personal perspective, and you said that you had to learn, mm-hmm. How to do these things. If you were going to give imparting wisdom on somebody who's getting into the game, mm-hmm. what are the things that you would tell them to look out for? Like, we talked a little bit earlier about you can't be, the most aggressive, super belligerent person, because mm-hmm. nobody, part of the reason I'm going to look at some art is to chill out.
Yep.
I'm trying to chill out. I might want to be internally frustrated or internally emotionally, but I don't want nobody yelling at me. Cool. Unless I'm going to a mixed media show or something that's going to have that element.
Okay, so if I were to I remember you had said it earlier on and I didn't answer your question, what would you tell you? And then now this is another version of this. I think that for me, I'm motivated by adversity. So the way I did it was kind of the way that worked for me. Someone else coming in, I would say two things. Number one, work on your fundamentals. That is something that no one can ever take away from you. And if you can draw a pair, if you can just put a pair in a box and you can draw that pair and everything be where it's supposed to be, the light parts are where it's at, the dark parts are where it's at, the shadow, then you're moving. And then go and then, or maybe try to paint or draw an egg. And those things are a lot more difficult than what you would think they are, just to get it to where it's soft, right? So work on your fundamentals. That's one thing. Number two, I would say document your work as much as possible. Good, bad, and ugly, because something can be learned from everything. And then I would say go out to your local events and start meeting people. And don't go in saying, hey, I'm an artist. Because there's nothing worse than me or some other artist busting their ass for 3 months to do a show. And then someone coming in who paints on the weekends and says, hey, I'm an artist too. Look at my art. And it's like there's a time and a place for that.
We can have that conversation later.
Give me a card. Like if you guys want to do it, give the person a card or get their Instagram and their contact info and talk to them later about your art. But it's someone else's art show. It's not your art show, right? And this is, and I've done this, you guys. I've been that guy, you know, and I could tell you stories about that. And it was just like, oh, I was tripping. But
don't go to someone else's concert with your mixtape.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So and when you're making those contacts and you're working on your chops, the people will see that. They're like, oh, this guy is focused on making things. He's not focused on trying to be cool. And you'll get a lot further. People will have, because you have to, the thing about art is like some people like making art, some people like showing art, right? But I think if you don't love making art, there's going to be a place that you can't go with your skills because you're going to run from a challenge, because that's all art is problem solving. So if I were, first thing I would say is don't do it, right? I would say, okay, number one, is there anything else you can do? Like, can you work a corporate job and then just do art on the side? And then that way you're not beholden to the art. Like I would suggest that. But if you're so set on like, yo, I gotta do this, yo, this is what I'm here for, like destiny, life, purpose, whatever, then take it slow. Slow means steady, steady means fast. Work on your fundamentals and just start to meet people. Go out and go to museums, and then that way you can see what museum quality artwork looks like. Because if you want to be in the Dean collection curated by Swiss Beats, or you want to like be accepted to the Black Rock Senegal or something like that, you have to understand like what it takes to get there. And usually it's either technique or you're bringing something new to the game. And to bring something new to the game is really hard and really rare.
And that's interesting, because I was going to ask you what art trends currently like maybe influence your work, or that you appreciate or have a, you know, you're like, oh, okay, that's dope. Maybe you might not do it personally, but you're like, oh, that's cool. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Art trends currently, I would have to say, that's a good question. Art trends, because you know what? A lot of my friends, Jared, they refer to me as a hipster. Right? You know what a hipster is?
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, I kind of run from shit like that, honestly. Like whatever, if I see like a lot of, and it sucks because if I see a lot of people doing something, I'm going to run from it.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
It definitely, but I'm wondering like what is, I would say like there's a lot of black people in art now, and I don't mean like black painters. I mean like models and just, the visibility. Actually, like
seeing black people in the work. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you know, people will come in and they'll ask me like, hey James, like you paint, you know, a lot of black people. Do you have any tips on painting black people? And that's such a weird question.
But it's the truth though. Cause if you're not used to doing
it. Yeah, no, I mean, for sure. And then so
it's not taught much.
Yeah. So, and you know, my thing is like, I try to, I'm always like, so I'm like, don't. And then I'll laugh and I say, it's one thing if you're painting your friend, like, hey, I want to paint Jared for his birthday, right? Okay. But it's another thing if I want to paint this person to show that I'm part of this politically correct movement of people that don't get invited to cookouts. Because I'm going to tell you what, I would much rather see a white person paint white people at cookouts than a white person paint black people. Because it shows a more level of understanding and them being immersed in our culture, as opposed to I sat with this person and they took pictures. And this is, you guys, I might alienate myself on a lot of people on this, but that's just my personal philosophy. I feel
it's like profiteering to a certain extent. Like, yeah.
And I think it's one thing when they're your friends, I feel like that's tight, but I feel like when you're just exploiting a movement, cough, cough, painting kids from Haiti, cough, cough. I think that it's a, It feels different. You know what I'm saying? So like I've seen artists like Mary Chiamonte or like Amanda Greer, they'll paint black people that are their friends, and it feels a lot different because they care about these people.
But I guess an argument can be made, though, that the more people that are picking up pencil, pen, pad, paintbrush, and creating these visions and these versions and this work with black people being seen, the better it is for people to see more black people being, you know?
Yeah, totally. And I'm going to tell you something, folks, listeners. I'm not, this is just James's artistic rant right here. You guys are getting no holes barred. This is the way I feel, not right, not wrong, James's feelings. And I do agree with that. I also think that no one can paint your wife like you. Like, if it, like, the level of love you have for your wife is going to come out in that painting.
Definitely,
so anybody else, I don't give a fuck how skilled they are.
It's not going to have the same
gonna
feeling.
It's going to miss that. Yeah. Right?
No, that's real.
That's all I'm saying.
Like, because my thing is, like, I know that recently, you know, I've seen a lot more diversity in commercials, which is a good thing because kids see representations of themselves, but it also is ultimately to sell product.
And let me rephrase that, because I just was thinking about an artist in general. I think that it's one thing, the exception to this is when you come up and you're from that environment, then you have a different view of it. You know, when you come up and you're around these people, then it seems like the artwork feels a little different and it feels a lot more authentic, as opposed to attempting to latch onto a movement or something.
No,
it's kind of like the people who smoke weed just because it's legal. And they're like, oh, I only do edibles, or oh, I don't do that. Or, oh, I, and it's like, nah, bro, you do whatever. Like, there's a time where you could only, like, it was however you got it. And you couldn't, like, I don't know, there's no flavors. It might be brick. It might be like some Dodi. Yeah, it might be some fire. It might be some Buddha.
You're smoking,
like,
you're smoking.
Yeah, exactly. You're and smoking, you're not, smoking. You can't choose. But now there's a, oh, I only do that. And I'm like, that's a luxury.
You yeah, it's like, there? You know, and I have vegan, vegetarian friends, pescatarian friends. Mm-hmm. It used to not be no choices. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to eat, you had to eat.
Yeah.
You know, now you have the luxury to have the option to choose what you choose to not eat or not eat, or eat or not eat. Because I always get into this thing about pork. I mean, feel as you may about pork, but it wouldn't be no black folks if it wasn't for no pork. We'd been gone.
It's true.
We'd be gone. And if you know anything about, like, food and stuff, like greens and pork, they go hand in hand because it's fat soluble. It's, you know, your fiber, your all your vitamins are in the greens. The pork fat, the pieces of meat that we're allowed to have that were mostly fatty would actually enhance. There's a reason we eat greens. Now, we're no longer working that hard. We're no longer, you know, so there's really no need to be eating hog maws and pig feet every day. But if you eat something every once in a while, it's just a throwback to our culture, you know, to our traditions, and to us living and still surviving as human beings. This is Dr. Jared Nicholas Dorch, Urban Soul Radio, taking over R&BS with my main James Gerald. We are getting into some good stuff now. So really, is there anything that you specifically have in your environment for you to create? Because, you know, like some artists, like, you know, they're doing a concert and I want like 500 red Skittles or whatever.
No,
like,
just weed and coffee.
Okay.
That's basically it.
It's like, coffee.
As long as I have that coffee.
They're both coffee, so yeah. I'm a big Devin the Dude fan, so that's coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. Coffee, I'll say shout out to Cooter Brown.
So, what are your favorite and least favorite parts of being a professional artist?
My least favorite part is dealing with money.
Yeah.
That is my least favorite part. My favorite part is hearing how the paintings resonate with different people. Because, you know, we have First Friday in Indianapolis. We have First Thursday in Fresno. So it's called Art Hop in Fresno instead of like First Friday, you know.
Because, yeah, so you go place to place. And,
yeah, so it's basically like last night was our First Friday. And so people will come in and I have all these paintings and I'll say, hey, what sticks out to you? Because oftentimes the viewer wants to know about the artist's connection to the painting. And I don't, that's not what I'm here for. I want to know, you know, what did Andre 3000 said? He said, I live beat to beat. Like, you live check to check.
Yeah.
If you don't move your feet, I don't eat, so we like neck and neck. So
it's been a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
We won't get, I won't go down the rabbit hole.
But it was it was a sentiment. So it's like, okay, well, what am I doing that's affecting these people? What's touching their hearts? And it's always interesting, you know, like some people will come in and I have you know, just different stuff. Some people like the portraits. Some people like the still life paintings. Some people like cityscapes. But the still life paintings, they're always contingent on a memory. So, for example, I painted this pan that has some eggs in it, and people will come in and it's typically like dudes, and they'll be like, bro, like my grandmother used to make me eggs in that pan, or like my mom had that pan. Definitely. You know, it was just a cheap Family Dollar pan.
Yeah.
Well, we have a hot plate in the building, and I was like, dude, I want to paint some eggs. So I went, got some eggs and cooked them up and put them in my shadow box and painted them. And the thing I didn't realize is when you're painting things that are perishable, usually like when we make eggs, we eat them within the first 15 minutes of them being on our plate. We don't let them sit for 3 hours. So when you let eggs sit for three hours, they start to dehydrate and fold up. Tightening up, as Jared said, you know, and it's like that for many different perishable items. So when you see painters paint things like avocados or sliced apples,
the avocados is a wrap in like 5 minutes.
Yeah,
it's dark. No, like my time before I even put it on the plate, it's already done turned dark. Yeah.
So, and it's funny, Jay, because I painted an avocado and it was dark, but I was having to think, how did that green look 15 minutes ago? So I painted it ripe, but it was done when I was like, it took me 3 hours to do the painting. So I'm painting like from my memory. So I think that those are things that, as an artist, I love the challenge of trying to race against the clock.
I've heard you say a couple of times about your memory and using your, like, trying to remember. Do you, like, not even being funny, but do you take pictures of stuff and then use that to, because?
Sometimes, but a lot of times it's, okay, so it depends on how far I want to go. Yeah, I'll take pictures, but I have, like, a setup where I have like two shadow boxes. I wonder if I have any studio pictures. So basically when I set stuff up, it's just going to be there. You know, like no one's going to move it. There's cloth. And I know I don't have no pictures of that. But actually.
Yeah, no, my wife, she uses shadow boxes for when she does her yarn so that she can get the best shots of it.
So, but I think also the way that I'm, I do take pictures, but I don't really use. If I'm painting off of a picture, it's like right there next to the thing that I'm painting. So I'm flicking my eyes back and forth from this thing to this thing. And then that way I'm moving it over.
I feel you. Okay. I was just wondering because I know a lot of people just that use photography.
Yeah.
They use photos and then they take the photo. And a lot of times they even put it into a program or whatever and work from there. But I was just wondering about that because, it seems like it'd be, I wouldn't say easier, but I think that you can capture the moment with those pictures, you know.
I try not to because the thing is you can't do this to a picture.
That's true. It's a flat screen. Right? Yeah.
So, and what I'm doing, you guys, is I'm moving my head around looking through it like if it was somebody trying to, you know, look through and see different perspectives. Okay, so, and that's the thing about painting from a photo is it flattens all the information.
That's true.
And nothing can, I don't care, you guys, like iPhones, that's tight, but nothing in a photo can capture scale. So if we're flattening and we're like distorting the scale, because when I come in here and I look at Jared's paintings of these hashtags, they're probably 12 inches by 12 inches.
These are Joy Hernandez, my art partner. I'm gonna buy them, but they mean a lot to me. But yes, they're, well, I'd say 12 by 12.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, 12 by 12.
So, there's a, if we're gonna paint that and whatever the image is that's gonna go in there, we have to be able to tell scale. So in a picture, sir, you can't really tell how big things are comparatively. And you can in relationships, but I think having something right in front of you and seeing like, oh, no, these letters are exactly this big and I'm going to move that over, it helps.
No, I understand. No, I was wondering because I know that a lot of times I've used like in my little bit of experience, I just use pictures because mm-hmm. it makes it a little easier for me. Mm-hmm. Especially when you're dealing with something, like you said, like that's going to wither away or mm-hmm. tighten up or however it's going to happen to it over time. Mm-hmm. But it makes sense. Mm-hmm. So do you have a network of other artists and how do they support you?
Yeah, man. All the time. Ideas. I will talk to certain artists and they'll help me punch my ideas up. Hey, James, like, oh, you want to do that, but then if you added this to it, that would be kind of crazy. Or have you ever thought about, or maybe think about this? So I think that not only in my conceptual practice, sometimes I'll run things by my neighbors or, you know, other artists, or sometimes I'll say, hey, man, can you come and look at this painting? Like, something's not working. What is it? I don't know what's not working, bro. And then one of, you know, my esteemed colleagues will say, well, hey, this is kind of what I see. And then I'll be like, oh, that's why. Okay, I need to fix that part. So I think that those are sort of things, and just the philosophy aspect of painting and drawing. So through, I think those are kind of the things that helped me, and we were able to cultivate ideas just through our conversation.
Oh, definitely. So what have critics and collectors said about your work?
That's a great one. Critics and collectors. Collectors, I say that they're, let's go critics. It's interesting because I always like to say my paintings are boring, right? So I would say that they, I don't really get, at this point in my career, I don't really get a lot of, like, criticism outside of, like, you know, it's more of a they want to know why I'm painting, you know, a lemon, or why I'm painting a, let's see, what else? It's like a
lighter or
yeah,
electric
yeah, yeah, like,
outlet.
Why, like, yeah, 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 like, why are you painting these things? So that's kind of the criticism, because there's never really, and other artists, I feel like they kind of, like, and these are my friends, you know, they'll be like, oh, James, like, you're not, like, usually your worth is kind of toothless, you know, and now you kind of got some bite to it. Or they'll, you know, we joke with each other because still life paintings, they don't really have an edge to them. Landscape paintings, they don't really have an edge to them. So I would say that that's the critique. I'm not painting Wells Fargo on fire. You know, that would have a little bit more edge to it. Like, there's a guy who, that's his whole thing, is he paints banks on fire. But I'm really trying to obtain this technique. And I would say collectors, they appreciate, a lot of people like when I do looser paintings, because it makes them feel like I get there faster. And it's a, like, oh, here's where this thing goes, here's where that thing goes. So people really like the fact that I can do loose paintings, or if I want to do tighter paintings, I'm able to do both. That's kind of what I've experienced from collectors as far as feedback.
I was gonna say, do you have an existing customer base?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, like, I market to, and I have an Excel spreadsheet.
Okay, so you've cultivated some patronage. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So this is a question that a lot of times I've been asked, or I ask a lot. What factors influence the price of your work?
Time, materials. Really, honestly, I try to make my work accessible at this point in my career, because I feel like some paintings that I really make and I like, I couldn't even afford if I wanted to. So I try to make things really as affordable as I can, which, yeah, man, using, like, high quality materials and pricing things to where they can be affordable is a gamble. But I think when it comes, like, larger paintings or commissions, I try to think about, like, how long this is probably going to take. And then I'm like, okay, well, depending on how long this is, like, if it's let's say if it's like a building and it has a lot of texture, like bricks and signage and stuff like that, I'm like, okay. And it's in 2-point perspective. I'm like, okay, this is probably going to take me 4 to 6 weeks. How much do I need to make in 4 to 6 weeks to kind of cover things and not die, You know, because if I have to put everything to the side to make this painting, it has to at least cover basic necessities. If it's a 3-hour painting, I feel like I can let that go for something that's a little bit more reasonable, because it's more the learning lesson. So it really depends, Jared, on, you know, if it's a study, if I varnish the painting, if it's a 3-hour painting, if the painting took me a month, because some paintings are 6 by 6 inches and they took me a month, and some are 6 by 6 inches and they took me 3 hours. So
that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Often, do you get attached to some of the work too?
Mm-mm. No, so, I don't care about nothing except for two things. There are two drawings that I'll never sell.
Okay.
And that's basically because they're my cast drawings, and they're things I never thought I could do before I entered fine art. Like the cover of my book, it's like the girl's head. Yeah. That's a charcoal drawing. And it's like 6 by 8 inches. It's real small. But I don't think I'll ever sell that one.
That makes sense. So what do you consider... like, what would be like your dream project to work on?
Realistically, there's a... my dream project to work on. That's a great question. There's a series that I'm kind of kicking around in my head that I've been working to get out there. And the title of this body of work is The Non-Threatening Black Man. And it's essentially the things that I've experienced in this art space and just in life being a non-threatening black man. Because for those who don't know, I'm like 5'6", 5'5", probably. And so I'm not like a 6'2 guy. I'm not a super muscular guy. Like, it really, like, for someone to be intimidated by me, it's like, okay, well, what are we really doing here? But I've had so many experiences because my personality is 6'2", that I can come across, you know, to be passionate. And some people can mistake passion for aggression if they're not listening to what's being said. So I wanted to capture those particular experiences within paintings, but I wanted to make sure that I could execute the paintings with the vision that I initially had and in the way that I feel like it should be brought to the public. So that's my dream project and something that I'm working towards within the next like year or so. I should start on the project and we'll see how long it takes to actually complete.
This is Dr. Jared Nicholas Dortch, Urban Soul Radio, taking over RNBS podcast. I've got one more question for you. It's, what is, in your opinion, the best work that you've ever created? And then kind of tell the story of how that came to be.
I would say the best thing that I've ever painted was probably, arguably, I would say that I like the kitchen mixer. I painted this kitchen mixer, and it was the first like long painting I did from life. So like it was this big blue KitchenAid mixer, and I was in a relationship at the time, and I was just painting this mixer. And it was just so toxic, and the relationship was crazy. And I remember one time, like at one point, painting this mixer, and the chick I was with just like came out into the garage and knocked all of my art stuff, like all of my mediums, all of my precious, everything just on the floor. Fuck this shit. And just like,
that's terrible.
And I just put my face, I put my face in my hands and I cried. I cried. Swear to God, I cried.
No.
Because I was like, I don't have any more money for paint thinner. I don't have any more. I was down bad. Like, I had nothing. Like, nothing coming in. And I was just like, what? How am I going to figure this out? Like, I'm betting everything on this. Oh, God. That was great. But I finished the painting. And it sold. But I think the adversity that I experienced to make that painting and the impact, because a lot of people, it had a lot of different materials in it. It had like, you know, a metal that was, it had chrome metal, it had polished metal, it had like a dark atmosphere to it. So people really... here because I want to bring those chords across. There we go. Sorry, guys. And hopefully that doesn't come through the thing. Yeah, we about to shit up. All these chords across. What was I talking about? Oh, the mixer. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I cried. And it was great. Because the thing is as artists, you should... I know I can't tell anybody what they do, but I let it all out, man. I have a palette knife that I use that I've never used for paint. And like, if there's tears going, I'll scrape the tears off my face and mix it in with my painting medium. And because it's like, no, this is really blood, sweat, and tears in this stuff. And I think that pain, anguish, heartache, those emotions are the hardest ones to manufacture. So when we're in them, we have to appreciate and get the most out of them. Because there is power in this place that we feel like nothing is right in life. There's nothing worth living for. There's power in that because it's easy to be happy. Like, we can eat a donut and we're happy. We can get a new pair of shoes and we're happy. We can, you know, kiss our mom and we're happy. We can, you know, buy something for somebody or something from somebody and we're happy. But to feel like pain and sadness, like this is pure and intense, you don't get that but a few times in your life. You know, so when I get that, I try to really, as weird as it sounds, I try to stay in it as much as I can and create something because I know that nothing out of that is going to come that's not true and honest in that moment.
Like we talked about, when I first met you, we talked about, I said, Obama's always said, you know, for every tragedy, that's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there's a tragedy that goes along with it, but it's an opportunity. I mean, mm-hmm. we as people, as culture, as technologically, every kind of way have grown because of necessity and tragedy. So
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the best painting that I feel like I've created. But also there's a Malcolm X painting that I really, really like that I did. And that it was supposed to be a birthday present to myself because we had the same birthday.
Same with my mom. Shout out to
Mom Dukes. Yeah. Taurus gang. Ow. But it was just, man, it was a mission because he had a camera and I wanted to do a different Malcolm X than everybody does because everybody does.
The gun with the window.
The
gun,
or the out. One with
yeah,
him.
The finger. Yeah.
Everyone does that. But I wanted to do like, yo, let's do his trip to Mecca. Like, let's do when he's out here, like, living life and really figuring it out.
I can see it in my head, like, literally him with that little silver camera. Yeah. Just awestruck about the beauty of the people. Yeah, man.
Yeah, so that's, like, one of my favorite paintings that I did.
And that's
it's, like, on my, you know, when I email, like, movers and shakers and stuff like that, it's on my
signature.
No, it's on my, what do you call that, my contact sheet because I have, like, a sheet of, like, paintings and stuff, but I'm trying to pull it up.
I take that note down contact sheet.
Yeah.
I need to have one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got so much work to do.
Yeah. Well, and that's the cool thing about this is it's community, and that's why community is invaluable.
That's dope.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so, it's that. And what's crazy is that painting, one of my friends, who's actually, I guess he's a collector also, he said, hey, is that a picture? Because, like, it was taped up on my wall. And I was like, nah, bro, that's a painting. And he looked at it. He's like, oh, shoot. And I was like, okay, this is a painting I'm probably never going to sell. But I think the chords are tripping. We should probably wrap this thing up. And because I don't even know what the hell's happening. So.
But once again, this is Dr. Jared Nicholas Dortch, Urban Soul Radio, taking over R&BS podcast. Mr. James
Gerald's.
I don't know how.
Like Gerald LeVert.
Yeah,
call you Gerard. You call me Gerald. It's cool.
Yeah, like,
so it could be Gerard Gerald.
Yeah, because no, my uncle is Gerald.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, but
James Gerald.
James Gerald's.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the name. For those of you that, you know, that's somebody that's doing it out here and a resource and a valuable asset to our community and to the culture. So, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to sit down and talk to you, chop it up for these last couple of days. Be safe. Hope to see you before you leave. And, appreciate it, man.
You could be anywhere on the internet, but you're here with us, and we appreciate that. Catch us again next week, same BS time, same BS channel. Once again, this is some shit I just thought of y'all. Scientific fiction, it's not admissible in a court of law. I'm out of here like Vladimir. This is the end of the Art and BS takeover.
Art and bullshit podcast.
I told you from the get-go. You don't gotta go home, but you gotta go. R&BS Podcast, Urban Soul Radio. Pull your socks up.